As we work our way through all of the potential culprits in the JFK assassination, we've been excavating the history of American-Soviet relations during the Cold War, with an eye towards answering the question of whether the Soviets had a hand in President Kennedy's murder. In this episode, we first turn to President Kennedy's move toward peace with Premier Khrushchev. Then, we assess the argument asserted by former CIA Director James Woolsey that Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy alone and with the help of the Soviets.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
I don't know what this is all about.
Dallas police this morning resumed custody. The man they have formally charged with the assassination of President Kennedy.
I'm just a
was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? The mission answers, he acted alone.
I'm lurking.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. President Kennedy entered the White House determined to put an end to nuclear proliferation throughout the world. His resolve was only strengthened during the Cuban Missile Crisis when the world came to the brink of nuclear annihilation. On May 6, 1963, Kennedy issued National Security Action Memorandum 239, which ordered his national security advisors to pursue a nuclear test ban and a policy of general and complete nuclear disarmament. As a first step to this extremely idealistic goal, Kennedy had been trying to convince Khrushchev to join him in a limited test ban treaty, which would allow the nuclear powers to keep their weapons, but would require them to stop poisoning the environment with nuclear tests. However, hardliners in both governments rejected attempts at peace and instead encouraged the two Cold War leaders to double down on militarism. On June 10th, in a commencement speech at American University, President Kennedy made a direct plea to the Soviet people for better relations. To avoid sabotage from the defense and State Departments, he kept the text of his speech a secret that only his closest advisors knew. In that now famous American University speech, JFK urged a genuine peace, not simply the old line of Pax Americana, or peace through American strength. Here's a clip.
In short, both the United States and its allies, and the Soviet Union and its allies, have a mutually deep interest in a just and genuine peace and in halting the arms race. Agreements to this end are in the interests of the Soviet Union as well as ours. And even the most hostile nations can be relied upon to accept and keep those treaty obligations, and only those treaty obligations, which are in their own interest. So let us not be blind to our differences, but let us also direct attention to our common interests and the means by which those differences can be resolved. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal.
President Kennedy's call for peace received little fanfare in the U.S., but Premier Khrushchev told British Labour Party leader Harold Wilson that the American University speech impressed him and helped Khrushchev push back against pressure from the Chinese government to not enter an agreement with the United States. On the heels of the American University speech, and a few days later, a direct hotline between the White House and the Kremlin being installed, there seemed to be a real opportunity to secure a nuclear testing treaty. Khrushchev's primary concern with the treaty was reaching a process to figure out whether an event was an earthquake or a nuclear test. He didn't want Western investigators inside the Soviet Union because that would reveal just how behind the Soviets were in the arms race. In June of 1963, not long after Kennedy's American University speech, Khrushchev agreed to the treaty, which banned all nuclear tests except for underground ones. On September 24th, the U.S. Senate approved the treaty by a vote of 80-19. While the limited test ban treaty didn't stop other countries from developing nuclear weapons, the treaty did mark a clear pause in what had been escalating Cold War tensions. On October 10th, after Khrushchev publicly signed the limited test ban treaty, Soviet Deputy Foreign Minister Valerian Zorin passed a note to American Ambassador Foy Kohler. The note was from Khrushchev to President Kennedy. Kohler, who was a Cold War hawk, never passed Khrushchev's letter on to the president. Khrushchev, on the other hand, thought the letter was important enough to read on Soviet state radio. Khrushchev's letter, which Ambassador Kohler played down, proposed, quote, a non-aggression pact between NATO countries and the Soviet Union, creation of nuclear-free zones in various regions of the world, measures for the prevention of surprise attacks, and a series of other steps. The State Department, which never told Kennedy about the note, drafted a two-sentence response to Khrushchev, which was never sent to him due to a clerical error in the State Department. While Kennedy never found out about Khrushchev's letter, he did take further actions in pursuit of peace with the Soviets, including selling them wheat after there was a severe grain shortage, against the advice of pretty much everyone in his cabinet. The president also called for joint efforts with the Soviets to go to the moon and to explore outer space. It appears that as of the time of Kennedy's death, his relationship with Khrushchev was at an all-time high. So what then is the argument that the Soviets killed President Kennedy? A 2021 book by former CIA director James Woolsey called Operation Dragon claims that Oswald fired the shots based on the orders of Khrushchev himself. A big part of Woolsey's argument comes down to Valery Kostikov. In episode 55, we covered Lee Harvey Oswald's alleged meeting with Kostikov, who was known at the highest levels of the CIA to be the most senior Soviet assassinations agent in the Western Hemisphere. There were many reasons to doubt that the real Oswald actually attended the meeting, including Oswald being sighted in Texas during that time, the CIA's surveillance of the Soviet and Cuban embassies failing to capture Oswald's voice or face, and most importantly, the statement from FBI Director Hoover to President Johnson that Oswald was impersonated at the Soviet embassy. Woolsey, without even addressing what Hoover told LBJ, says that Oswald did meet with Kostikov and that the purpose of that meeting was to plan the assassination of President Kennedy. Woolsey theorizes that the Soviet agents working with Oswald were George de Morenschild in Dallas and Kostikov in Mexico City. According to Woolsey, Khrushchev changed his mind and tried to call the assassination off, but Oswald went forward with it anyway. We know from a book written by Soviet embassy official Oleg Nechiporenko that someone who claimed to be Lee Harvey Oswald met with officials at the Soviet embassy, including Kostikov. If Lee Harvey Oswald really did meet with the head of assassinations for the Soviet Union 6 weeks before President Kennedy was assassinated, the implications of that meeting are massive. It would demonstrate that Oswald was not just a lone nut, and instead, he was, at a minimum, in contact with the Soviets for the purpose of killing the president. On the other hand, if Oswald did not actually meet with Kostikov, then we have to explain all of the evidence that's in the record to make it look like he did, and then try to understand why that evidence was created in the first place. We previously noted that on October 8, 1963, after Oswald's alleged meeting with Kostikov, the Mexico City CIA station requested information from CIA HQ on Oswald. When CIA HQ responded, it knowingly provided an outdated file on Oswald that did not have information about his time in New Orleans or his interactions with the Cuban exiles. When John Newman and Jefferson Morley showed Jane Roman these files and asked why the wrong information was sent to the Mexico City station, she admitted that she was, quote, signing off on something she knows not to be true. And Roman wasn't the only one who misled the Mexico City station. James Angleton's aide, Ann Egerter, and Tom Karamasinas, the assistant deputy director of plans, also knew about the skullduggery. You may remember that around the same time that Jane Roman signed off on the incomplete Oswald file, a man named Marvin Giesling at the FBI turned off the flash alert on Oswald on October 9th, the day before it would have been triggered by the October 10th response from CIA HQ to Mexico City Station. On top of that, we can't forget the strange details of Oswald's phone calls and visits with the Cuban and Soviet embassies. For example, the first call from this supposed Oswald person to the Soviet consulate was exclusively in Spanish. But when Oswald spoke to the Soviets from the Cuban embassy, it was in broken Russian. One of the days when Oswald was said to have made a call from the Cuban embassy to the Soviet embassy, the Cuban embassy was closed and a call would have been impossible. And finally, the CIA's wiretaps and photographic surveillance of both embassies failed to create any evidence to show that Oswald was there. Although, according to the CIA, there was evidence, they just erased it. And those are just a few of the problems with believing either the official story about Oswald's Mexico City trip or James Woolsey's theory. This, of course, begs the question, why would the CIA HQ lie about Oswald's file before President Kennedy was assassinated if Oswald was just some lone nut? There's something about spring that feels like a reset. Longer days, fresh energy, and the motivation to try something new. Learning a language is the perfect way to channel that momentum into a skill that opens up the world. Plus, if you start now, that means by summer, you'll already feel more confident speaking and understanding your new language. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you naturally absorb your new language. No memorizing random vocabulary lists or relying on translations. Instead, you learn by connecting words, visuals, and meaning in context. The way language is actually meant to be learned. One of the best things about Rosetta Stone is how simple the lessons are to fit into your day. If you only have 10 minutes to work on it, then you can do something with that time that will actually help you in learning your new language. Personally, I want to go to Spain one day, and I want to be able to speak the language there when I make the trip. I know that I'll be using Rosetta Stone to help make that happen. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages to choose from, including Spanish, French, German, Japanese, and more. Rosetta Stone is the go-to tool for real language growth. Are you ready to start learning a new language this spring? Visit rosettastone.com/today to explore Rosetta Stone and choose the language that's right for you. Go to rosettastone.com/today and begin your language learning journey. Okay, so I've never been a huge weed person, but this guy that I know, let's just say, is. So whether you're like me or the guy I know, or you're really into weed, whatever it is, you're about to nerd out big because there's this company called Mood.com, that's changing the way people buy cannabis. Here's the science, and this is the part I love. The reason different cannabis strains make you feel different ways isn't just about THC. It's also based on other components called terpenes. Terpenes influence how your bud tastes and smells, but they also affect what you feel. So one terpene might make you feel uplifted and energetic, and another one makes you relaxed and sleepy. There are dozens of these. So when you have the right combination of terpenes, you can feel social, focused, creative, aroused, chilled out, or whatever. You just go to mood.com, click Shop by Mood, and that's it. Want to be more social at a party? There's flower for that. Need to focus and get more work done? There's flower for that. Want to melt into your couch and watch movies? Yep, flower for that too. And here's the part few people realize. It's now 100% federally legal to have really great bud shipped right to your door. It's third-party lab tested and comes in a discreet box. Best of all, everything is backed by Mood's 100-day satisfaction guarantee. And like I said, you can get 20% off with code JFK. So head to mood.com and get 20% off of your first order with code JFK. Aside from Mexico City, Woolsey argues that there is additional evidence that Oswald was working with the Soviets in an operational capacity in the form of a letter from Oswald to the Soviet embassy in November of 1963. On Monday, November 18th, just days before President Kennedy would be killed, the Soviet embassy in Washington received a letter signed Lee H. Oswald. The letter said, quote, "This is to inform you of recent events since my meetings with Comrade Kostin in the embassy of the Soviet Union in Mexico City." The letter continues, quote, "I had not planned to contact the Soviet embassy in Mexico, so they were unprepared. Had I been able to reach the Soviet embassy in Havana as planned, the embassy there would have had time to complete our business." The phrases "as planned" and "our business" appear to reference some pre-existing plan that Oswald had with the Soviets. Woolsey asserts that Oswald's use of the name Kostin when referring to Kostikov in that letter demonstrates that Oswald knew Kostikov's code name and was using it. Conversely, the letter, which was dated November 9th and postmarked November 12th, also contains a reference to the removal of Cuban consulate official Eusebio Askew. Oswald's letter says, quote, "The Cuban consulate was guilty of a gross breach of regulations. I am glad he has since been replaced." The challenge with this statement from Oswald, for people who assert that the letter is authentic, is that Eusebio Askew was not removed from his role at the Cuban consulate until November 18th. There's no way that Oswald could have known about Askew's future November 18th termination when the letter was postmarked on November 12th. From the perspective of the Soviets, we now have the documents available from the Soviet side to see how they handled this letter. On November 26th, Ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin sent a top-secret telegram from Washington to Moscow saying, quote, "This letter was clearly a provocation. It gives the impression we had close ties with Oswald and were using him for some purposes of our own. It was totally unlike any other letter the embassy had previously received from Oswald, nor had he ever visited our embassy himself. The suspicion that the letter is a forgery is heightened by the fact that it was typed, whereas the other letters the embassy had received from Oswald before were handwritten. One gets the definite impression that the letter was concocted by those who, judging from everything, are involved in the president's assassination. It is possible that Oswald himself wrote the letter as it was dictated to him in return for some promises, and then, as we know, he was simply bumped off after his usefulness had ended." We should note that there is corroboration for Oswald actually writing this letter. Ruth Payne said that she saw Oswald type the letter at her house on her typewriter on November 9th, the date of the letter. Payne also found a handwritten copy of the letter and gave it to the FBI. So either Oswald really did write the letter, or Ruth Payne participated in providing cover for someone else who wrote the letter. Aside from Kostikov meeting a man who claimed to be Oswald in Mexico City, and the Oswald letter to the Soviet embassy in November of 1963, James Woolsey raises additional arguments why Oswald was a Soviet spy. First, Oswald was trained in the use of microdots, as Oswald mentioned to Dennis Osteen, his co-worker at Jagger's Charles Stovall. Woolsey, the former CIA director, confirmed that hiding microdots under a postage stamp was a favorite technique of the KGB. Further, the fact that the first 18 pages of Marina Oswald's Book of Useful Advice were missing is consistent with the Soviet microdot system, where pages of a common book would be used to decipher codes. The argument that Oswald knew how to use microdots and thus must be connected with intelligence is usually used by critics of the case against the Warren Commission to assert that Oswald had intelligence ties. However, Woolsey uniquely claims that Oswald did have knowledge of microdots, but that it was from the Soviets as opposed to American intelligence. Second, Woolsey notes that there are, quote, dozens of KGB codes and operational patterns in the evidence, but none of them were identified by the Warren Commission because they didn't understand KGB spycraft. Finally, Woolsey asserts that Marina Oswald's backstory was consistent with the backstory of other women who married foreigners on behalf of the KGB, which is supported by a 29-point CIA document outlining why the agency thought Marina was associated with Soviet intelligence. The conversations that the new president, Lyndon Johnson, had with those around him in the hours and days immediately after the assassination helped to shed light on President Johnson's mindset. Did Johnson think the Soviets were involved? And if so, what steps did he take in response? At Parkland Hospital, Johnson said to Press Secretary Malcolm Kilduff, quote, "We don't know whether it's a communist conspiracy or not. Are they prepared to get me out of here?" Despite LBJ's apparent concern of a Soviet conspiracy, he made no attempts to contact the White House Situation Room, the Joint Chiefs, or the Secretary of Defense. When Johnson spoke to Secretary McNamara around 6:20 p.m., he simply asked, quote, "Any important matters pending?" Not exactly what you would expect a president to ask if he was worried about a Soviet conspiracy. On the night of the assassination, as soon as Johnson and his team were back in Washington, Johnson aide Cliff Carter called Dallas DA Henry Wade, Texas Attorney General Wagner Carr, and Dallas Police Chief Jesse Curry, asking all of them to avoid any discussions relating to conspiracy. According to Wade, Carter told him, quote, "Any word of a conspiracy, some plot by foreign nations, to kill President Kennedy would shake our nation to its foundation. President Johnson was worried about some conspiracy on the part of the Russians. It would hurt foreign relations if I alleged a conspiracy. Whether I could prove it or not, I was to charge Oswald with plain murder." So Johnson talked about being worried that the Soviets were behind President Kennedy's death, but his actions didn't match his words. In my view, the most important piece of evidence on the question of whether Johnson really believed in a communist conspiracy is what remains of the transcript of Johnson's call with J. Edgar Hoover on the morning after the assassination. As previously noted on this podcast, the phone call, which is about 15 minutes long, was intentionally erased at some point. To add further confusion, the written transcript of the call that survived appears to cover less than half the length of the call. In other words, not only was the tape deleted, some of the transcript was almost certainly removed as well. Even still, the surviving transcript raises serious doubts about the Oswald-Kostikov meeting. In the transcript, Johnson asks, quote, "Have you established any more about the visit to the Soviet embassy in Mexico in September?" We don't know how Johnson knew about Mexico City, but he must have found out either earlier during this call, and it was erased, or some other time after the assassination and before 10 a.m. the next morning. Hoover responds to LBJ's question as follows, quote, "No, that's one angle that's very confusing for this reason. We have up here the tape and the photograph of the man who was at the Soviet embassy using Oswald's name. That picture and the tape do not correspond to this man's voice, nor to his appearance. In other words, it appears that there was a second person who was at the Soviet embassy down there." Hoover followed up after his call with Johnson by sending a 5-page memo to the president that said FBI agents reviewed the tape of the man claiming to be Oswald at the Soviet embassy and concluded that the voice was not Lee Harvey Oswald's. Another memo from Hoover to James Rowley of the Secret Service said, quote, "Agents who have conversed with Oswald in Dallas have observed photographs of the individual referred to above and have listened to a recording of his voice. These special agents are of the opinion that the above referred to individual was not Lee Harvey Oswald." So J. Edgar Hoover was certain that the accused assassin was not in Mexico City with Kostikov. If Johnson was really worried about a communist plot, it seems to me that he'd have some questions when hearing from Hoover that it wasn't really Oswald in Mexico City. Like, for example, what do you mean it was a second person down there? Johnson demonstrated a surprising lack of curiosity about the details of Hoover's claim that Oswald was impersonated in Mexico City. If it was just a lack of curiosity, that would be one thing. But LBJ completely ignored Hoover's statement about an Oswald imposter and then knowingly lied to future Warren commissioners to get them to agree to work on the case. We know for sure that Johnson strongly implied to Earl Warren and Richard Russell that Oswald did meet with Kostikov in Mexico City. Here's Johnson bragging to Senator Russell about how he convinced Chief Justice Warren to serve on the commission.
"Well, you want me to tell you the truth? You know what happened? Bobby and him went up to see him today, and he turned him down cold and said no.
Yeah.
2 hours later, I called him and ordered him down here, and he didn't want to come. I insisted he come. He came down here, and he told me no twice. And I just pulled out what Hoover told me about a little incident in Mexico City, and I said, now, I don't want Mr. Khrushchev to be told tomorrow and be testifying before camera that he killed this fella and that Castro killed him, and all I want you to do is look at the facts and bring any other fact in here and determine who killed the president. And I think you'd put on your uniform, World War One, bad as you are, and do anything you could to save one American life. And I'm surprised that you, the Chief Justice of the United States, would turn me down." And he started crying. He said, "Well, I won't turn you down. I'll just do whatever you say."
Since we know that Hoover told LBJ that Oswald was impersonated at the Soviet embassy, it's a near certainty that Johnson, one, did not believe that there was a Soviet conspiracy, and two, actively used the threat of a Soviet conspiracy to recruit respected officials for his presidential commission. Johnson then directed them towards doing the right thing and finding that Oswald alone killed Kennedy, or else there would probably be a nuclear war if the truth was pursued. I think that's what Johnson meant when he said, you put on your uniform. When we compare Oswald's alleged Kostikov meeting with the known false claim from CIA informant Gilberto Alvarado that Oswald was paid by the Cubans to kill Kennedy, we find that Kostikov is only alluded to in the Hoover-Johnson call on the 23rd. However, the Alvarado claim was communicated in frequent and detailed messages. This raises the question, if Oswald was really working for the Soviets, why was so much effort spent on the false claim of Alvarado, but almost no ink or time was spent on the headline that Oswald supposedly met with the head of Western Hemisphere Assassinations for the KGB? Next time on Solving JFK, we wrap up the series on the Soviet Union as a potential culprit by looking at newly released Soviet documents related to the assassination of President Kennedy. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.